listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host of the most, Nikki Kolula, for another pandemic / quarantine episode of Wake Up Hollywood. We're still not back in the studio, but the show must go on. We will carry on. Today we have an amazing director in the horror film genre named Chad Farron. So let's welcome Chad Farron. Chad, how are you, man?
Doing well, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Did I say your last name correctly?
Sure. It sounded good.
First of all, I knew I was going to like you because I was reading your bio, and it was one of the first lines said that this guy sold his house. You sold your house to make your first movie. I'm like, that is a true artist right there. I love that. I mean, that is it's a huge sacrifice to do something like that. I want to first ask you about that. What made you do that? Because most people would think you're bonkers, but as an artist myself who has sacrificed lots of things like that, I understand, and I think it's an amazing testament to your creative direction, passion, and artistry.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I came out to L.A. in like 95. I worked as a production assistant for a company called Neo Motion Pictures, who I got in there because I'm a producer, and years later, I'm like, hey, I want to make movies. I called them up and said, hey, can you give me a job? And they're like, sure, come on down.
Wow.
Packed my car, drove to L.A., and the rest is history. And so I worked on a few films for them, and then, you know, I was like, you know what, I want to make my own film. I'm like, well, I don't have any money, and I pitched the idea to them, and they're like, this sounds too extreme for us. So I'm like, I need to make some money, so I sold my house in Minnesota and took that money and made Unspeakable. And
amazing. I mean, honestly, not a lot of people would think about doing that because it's like that sense of security is kind of taken away from you. By the way, your screen is over to my right, so if it looks like I'm not listening to you, I am listening to you. That's just where you are on my screen. I always have to tell the guests, so it doesn't look like I'm like looking away, like not paying attention, but that's where you are. But you know, it's like a house is something that represents some investment, some security, some commitment, and you rolled the dice to make this first movie, and I think it's tremendous. I honestly think it's pretty badass, and it made me respect you right away, and you know, it made me want to see your movies, honestly, because when you're willing to do that, I mean, I don't know a lot of directors that now would do that, even when they're comfy homes that are established, you know, like, that's a huge risk to do that. And when you do that, it speaks a lot about how committed you are to your craft. And so let's go way back. What was the movie that made you want to make movies?
Oh, wow. I really have to say it's not really a movie per se, but television, where, you know, the Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, all these things, being a little kid watching a black and white TV. And I still, you know, the memories are so fresh. The 4 a.m. or whatever it is, just glued to that little 13-inch black and white TV, eyes just, you know, inflamed with what was going on and filling my head with this stuff. To the point, I mean, I was such an introvert because I loved television and this black and white world that I'm like, when you got out and saw color and everything, I was like, I'd rather go back to, you know, this other reality that is so much more interesting and exciting than what I was living in at the time.
And what city in Minnesota are you from?
I was from 30 miles, or no, it was 7 miles out of a little town called New Prague.
Okay.
And we're 30 miles south of Minneapolis on a farm.
My drummer in my band is from Minneapolis, so I've been out there a couple of times. I went to Paisley Park, so I've got a lot of love for Minnesota, man. You got a lot of great funk music and great musicians that come out of that scene, so
no, that's great.
Tremendous vibe over there. But It's very cold. So I'm sure that also made you want to move to LA. But tell me how, you know, one thing in your bio that said some of these, you know, early kind of memories influenced the way you wanted to talk about storytelling or make movies. Talk about how some of that, you know, influenced your art.
Well, you know, I grew up on a farm, and, you know, the seeing animals die and, you know, killing them at times and things like that really kind of puts everything in perspective, where, you know, what's at the grocery store wrapped in a package was once a living, breathing, you know, being. And so you just kind of look at the world a little different, and the cold and the harsh weather and that thing also kind of had an impact, where it's like, you know how bad it can be.
Right.
And, you know, and, you know, it can be scary. You know, life is not just this, I'm safe in a little bubble and whatever. You could be killed at any time, whether it be a tree falling on you, or you're stuck out in the cold and you freeze to death, or you start, you know, it kind of just puts things in reality. And I've kind of just lived that feeling my whole way of life, is just kind of, you know, do the best you can in the moment, treat right. people like you'd want to be treated, because I could be dead tomorrow. And the fact that I'm doing this interview now is a great, you know, moment to be having someone who's interested in my work listening to what I'm saying, and people 2 or 3 or 3 or 4,000 or whatever watching, listening. That's a big moment. I mean, it's something to not sneeze at, you know, and a lot of people, I think, take that for granted. I mean, there's some actors that were doing kind of a press junket, and they're like, well, how much do I get paid, or what do I do this for? And I'm like, Jesus, you should be thankful that someone wants to listen to what the fuck you got to say.
Right, right.
And you show up.
I mean, you realize that's what sets people apart, the people that are willing to do the work on a level that is way beyond what they're asked for. Those are the artists that I prefer to work with. You know, I find that with musicians too, the same thing. It's like, and you know, like where people are at when they make those statements, you immediately just know, this is not a long-term person that right. you're probably going to work with, you know, or it's maybe it's somebody that you just doesn't see your vision. And, you know, it's like, even just seeing your trailer, I'm like, you have to know that you have vision, because the shots are beautiful. You have these like sweeping shots, and then you're also making this story just with images, even on a trailer. Like, we have so many guests that are filmmakers, and we've had casts on our show, and you really can tell the good from the bad, the good from the great. And you know, it is a testament. You can see it right away that your film is shot well. There's a really great ensemble, but it's really you telling the story with your lens. And that's what I'm most excited about seeing and learning about with this film. So, you know, you made this first Unspeakable movie. Now you're drawn to the macabre. You know that you like to spook people. There had to have been a horror movie that did that for you. I mean, you said The Twilight Zone, but...
I guess, you know, Mario Bava's Black Sunday is one that really knocked me out. And then it's one of those things where when a film impacts you, then you seek out everything the director's done, and then you're just like, wow. And then he was also the DP on a lot of them. And you get a respect that is like, you know what, that's what I want to do. And whether I could even come near that greatness is not really my desire. My desire is to kind of find... And at first, it was my desire. But then you realize it's like, you know what? You've got to be who you are. And it might not be you're as talented as Orson Welles or Mario Bava, or you're as good an actor as, you know, Cliff Robertson or whoever it might be. But you find your niche. And if you're having fun doing it, and it's entertaining and it's exciting and it's you loving what you're doing, then do it. And if someone says it's shit, if someone says it's garbage, take it in stride and just say, well, this other person thought it was great, or you said it was, you know, this and that. So there's just an opposite side to everything in the world. So
most of the time, people don't know shit from shit. You know what I mean? It's like, so, you know, not to, you know, be so blunt, but, you know, I'm an artist that does things very unconventionally. I actually recorded my last record all on analog tape. You know, I'm not using any computers, and that is shunned upon in today's world of tech, you know? So I applaud that you further, you know, support your own vision, but also shake off any negative criticisms, because you're going to get them. You're always going to get negative criticisms. And I find that the high praise is just as flagrant as the negative criticisms. For me, it's like, and I'm sure you feel the same way, like making this movie or making all of your movies, you just want to find a narrative where you can tell your story and have your voice and be kind of like recognized as like having a way to tell storytelling that becomes your signature. But all these little chapters that are your movies are chapters to your own story in art. So it's like, none of it matters what anybody else thinks. We're lucky that you are seeing the movies through, because it's a hell of an accomplishment. You know, like I've been like kind of working into that world of film and going to a bunch of film festivals for an animated project I've been doing. And I've learned, you know, everybody says at every film festival, the real reward and merit is finishing the movie. So the very fact you have all these movies that you've finished and you're willing to sacrifice your own kind of like level of safety or infrastructure, or, you know, it's commendable, man. And I'm telling you, from one artist to another, keep making movies, man, because the world needs it. The world needs that kind of like that escapism. We need to be spooked, because there's something that is so, I'm also drawn to the macabre as well. So there's something that's so exhilarating about that rush when you see somebody is able to scare you. And it's, sometimes it's the visual, sometimes it's the story, sometimes it's the blood and guts, sometimes it's the music, sometimes it's all of it. So I love that you, you know, were able to find, you know, a voice in all this and make some sense out of it. What was the biggest obstacle you went through? Let's maybe say for each movie, whether it was like getting the funds, or maybe it was like pulling off some special effect, or maybe it's hiring a DP or whatever it was. What was like the biggest obstacle you've had, maybe from movie to movie?
Well, the biggest
don't worry, it's okay.
So the biggest obstacle was on Unspeakable. You know, the first film, you're making something for $20,000, shot on film, limited, kind of learning the whole ins and outs. So even though I had worked as a PA and all these other jobs on other films, much bigger budget films, you're still, when you're kind of thrown into having to do everything from the, you know, getting the catering together to producing it hands-on and directing it with actors and writing the script, it was a lot to handle. But so exciting and so fun. But the obstacles mainly were the DP that I worked with was very, very meticulous.
Right.
And when you're trying to do, you know, a 90-page screenplay in 10 days, so you basically have to do 9 to 10 pages a day to get the damn thing done, this guy was spending, you know, way too much time lighting a scene, and it was slowing us down and slowing us down and slowing us down. And, you know, we'd have to be, okay, we can't do that scene. We'd be ripping pages out of the script that we can't do this. And it's like, boy, this lighting looks great. But when it all boils down, no one gives a shit if it looks like the fucking Godfather.
That's true.
It's in focus, and you're getting what's on the page, and the acting gets through, and you finish it, like you're saying, and then it's great. Especially for the money you've got to do it.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever walked out of a movie theater and been like, man, how about that lighting?
So, but I learned, you know, like, I had no backup. There was no, you know, I didn't think at the time, when I was 25-year-old, 24-year-old kid, I was like, I didn't have it all set up to fire and replace the guy if need be, which I've learned since that because of him, because it was one of those things, you know, you're going to let one person who's creative and talented, and I take nothing away from that, but was not prepared for getting in there, you know, and doing the most to get the best thing in the quickest amount of time to do it. So people aren't standing around and itching their head and go, why is this taking so long? Because then it infects everyone in the crew, and they're having a miserable time because you're not moving and you're not getting shit done. So that negative energy infects everyone to the point they're like, this is the most miserable experience in our life.
Wow. I learned about that. That's crazy.
I learned from that point, always have a backup for everyone on the crew ready to go. If an actor stinks, fire him immediately. Have someone ready in the wings to take his place. Same with the DP. Same with everyone on the cast and crew. replace them immediately if they're going to be a problem. Not even a problem, but even if they're just a bad energy.
Yeah.
Because everyone should feel like they're accomplishing something in their job, or have ideas to throw out, and that is welcoming and a collaborative effort. I mean, it takes everyone to make a good movie. And if, as a director, if you're willing to listen to those voices and at the same time have a firm hand, it's like, you're a negative person, get the hell out of here, because right. you're only going to...
Well, it's hard enough. Let's be honest. It's like, it's hard enough. This is why artists die young. You know, it's like, it's hard enough. And what I've learned and really learned to respect is how tremendous movies are. Like, the amount of time, energy, and... finances, and also just like the attention to detail of everybody you have to keep in mind as you're making a movie. It's like, and you're adding special effects. Like, you don't even need special effects to add to the like how crazy making a movie is, because it's like one big, it's like literally you're the circus leader and you're just like, all right guys, let's run this circus into town and let's do this in an orderly fashion. Somehow it comes together and sometimes it doesn't, but I mean, honestly, and it's a thankless job when you're doing it, I know, because I'm a band leader myself, and man, I'm sure you wear many hats and you're just like willing to make it happen. But that's what makes it also super rewarding when you see it finished, when you see the movie in your hands. You're the person that gets to kind of like savor that first, you know, because you're getting the experience. Oh my God. What was it like when you saw your movie first in a theater? Because you have had a feeling where you're like, oh my God, it's in a film festival. Oh my God, what was that oh my God moment for you when you saw your own work being showcased?
Well, it was amazing. The Ghoul, I'd seen, you know, Unspeakable played in Cannes outside the festival, but in a smaller theater. And it was really an exciting thing to be in a foreign country. Best time of my life. Really. One of those things that were just like a whirlwind within a month's time in a place. And it was just, you know, still one of the greatest moments of my life. And
amazing.
So that tops it. But there was also my next film or The Ghouls played at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, which was
That's amazing.
Amazing thing. And Variety was there and wrote just a phenomenal review of it, which, you know, was back when it was in the print magazine. So it was, you know, run out. See, oh my God, you're holding up Variety magazine.
That's awesome.
And Miramax had called me up wanting to buy the remake rights. I mean, it was a big whirlwind of things. I'm like, holy shit, this is it. But then reality sets in, and the man who wanted to do the remake gets fired or let go or disappears. Right. The deal goes in the toilet, and then it's back to, you know, shuffling, trying to find another way to make a movie and sell whatever I need to sell or whatever it might be. But
you know what? It's like, that's part of the process, unfortunately. But what's amazing is every filmmaker I know that – you know, is making movies either independently or even on a bigger... The weird thing is you'd think having a huge movie house fund your movie, that's the end of all the problems. But it's actually a whole new set of problems that you didn't have to deal with when you were self-funded or just funding it yourself. So, you know, it's like one of those things that, you know, the most important thing is you're staying true to your vision as an artist and making these movies, and they're being celebrated. So... it will happen. If it doesn't happen soon, I mean, I literally looked at your trailer. I watched the whole thing, but 10 seconds in, I was like, this guy knows how to make movies. So anybody that sees your work knows you know how to tell a story and make something intriguing, because that's all we want, is we want to be entertained as an audience, you know? So we look for people that know how to entertain us, and you definitely do that. I love how honest and candid you are. We're definitely going to be friends, man, because... we see things in a lot of the same light.
The greatest thing when you click with people like yourself, it's just like you instantly know there's a good energy there.
Right.
You relate to that and you connect with that. You know, some people you don't. I've worked with many actors where it's just they don't like me and I don't like them. But right. You get through it and you make it work and you can respect whatever they're bringing to it and, you know, and make it work.
But well, I'll tell you, anytime you have a movie – you come and do a guest spot on this show anytime you want to showcase something. Because that's why I started this. It's like, you know, artists aren't in enough, you know, places where they can help other artists. And that's really where it comes from. It's like the more mediums that can spread the word and showcase. And the other thing too, it's like, I know you've done a lot of TV shows and interviews, man. I play Sundance every year, and I've done so many, you know, TV talk shows, or I've done, you know, all kinds of morning news shows. And sometimes you just don't get in-depth questions about your work. And that's like, really, I can't stand that. I want in-depth questions about the art, the process, the inspiration behind it. I want the real answers. Like, you know, all the things you just said already, it's like, that's the stuff that makes interviews to me fascinating, when it's like, yo, don't censor this. Don't make this like, so it's this, you know, made for success story. No, give me the real stuff that every artist that is trying to be inspired by can relate to, because there are people you're inspiring just with what you're saying right now that are trying to make
art. That's a good point. And for me, I gave up the success aspect long ago, because it's the same way when making a movie. It's like, okay, should I be completely prepared and all this stuff and have the storyboards and all that stuff? And I found that that process was so restrictive.
Right. Of
what you actually do on a no-budget film, and you get there and you look behind the camera and you see the actors doing it, you're like, this doesn't work.
Right.
This isn't what was in my head. So I learned long ago to basically bend to what comes to me. So it's like, okay, this location, it's all we can afford. You go there, it's like, okay, this will work. And you look it through the camera and you're like, okay, run the actors through it. This is it. Two shots, we're done, we're out of here, move it, bang, boom. Whereas before, it was like in the script, this big, long thing, but it's like reality comes in, budget constraints come in, and everything that you were fighting against, if you just go with that flow and say, let's make this work, and have that kind of attitude, free-flowing ideas from the actors, or, hey, she's got a better suggestion for this line, or whatever it is, or the DP thinks, hey, let's just get this in a master shot. And if it works and it looks good and it clicks for you as a filmmaker, then go with it. And don't be caught up on, well, we need this Citizen Kane shot where the camera comes down and does all this. Sometimes that's great, and I love that stuff. But sometimes it's like it's a waste of energy, time, money, and effort when 90% of the audience is just going to be like,
right,
I don't care. Right. But but if you can achieve it, great. But why knock yourself out when there's other things throughout the big picture of a film when you're making it to strive to not to really nail it, whether it be a performance or whether it be the music or whether it be whatever thing. Focus on the big picture instead of the little elements that all come together.
I love it. I know that I've got some blood and guts questions, but I want to talk about your movie, The Deep Ones, sure, because it's premiering April 23rd at Lemley in NoHo, and it's being showcased in a couple theaters. And I think it's, first of all, it's super amazing. But I want to talk to you about the story. You have some really peculiar elements. Like, there's one character, it's like, oh, can you see the light? And he's using a little Zippo lighter. Tell me how you came up with this story, this idea, this concept to try to make a horror movie that was different and for the times.
Well, it all started with the main actress and actor, Robert Miano, who had introduced me to Gina LaPena, who plays the lead actress in the film, who gets, well, we won't get into it. We had some fun with something. But he had introduced me to her for another project. I had a female Death Wish script kind of rolling around, and he's like, hey, she'd be great for this. I mean, she's Latina, like in your script, and, you know, you should meet her. So I met her, and, you know, we had a nice meeting, and she really loved the script and was going to try to raise some money for it, and we were going to go, you know, make it for a couple hundred grand. And I said, great, you know, and then a month goes by, I don't hear anything, and I'm like, oh, another one of those, you know, a meeting. You know, Genghis Cohen, and they just fly by night and disappear. And then she had sent me an email.
I used to play at Genghis Cohen, by the way, dude.
Oh, I love that place. So she shoots me an email that basically says, hey, look, I can't find the money to do God's Lonely Woman, but would you be able to crank out like a cheap slasher film? Because I got this beach house in Ventura. We could film here. I can get some of my friends. We can do all this stuff, and I'll put in, you know, a few bucks. So I'm like, well, let me think about it. Send me some pictures of the house. You know, let me wrap my head around the location. And then she sent the pictures, and I'm like, wow, this is is impressive. You get right on the ocean, all this stuff. So I that started getting the wheels turning, and I'm like, okay, let me write a script around this location. And then I'm like, the beach. When I think of the beach, I think of H.P. Lovecraft and sea monsters and things like that. So I'm like, let me tackle some Lovecraft elements in this thing. And I'm like, I love cults. So, you know, Jim Jones kind of shit. So let me add that into it. So it was just kind of taking what we originally had was, you know, this location and this actress and kind of bringing it all together and letting it flow from there. And it really actually came really easily. And then I started.
How long did it take for you to write the screenplay?
Oh, 2 weeks.
Wow. Seriously? Including rewrites?
Yeah. Well, you know, once everyone was kind of, once she was cast and she had some notes, Robert Miano had some notes, and, you know, going by through that, and then maybe another week of kind of touching it up and polishing it out. But it was mainly, you know, just taking kind of the Rosemary's Baby structure, pulling in some Lovecraft elements and meshing it together. And it came surprisingly one of the easiest scripts. But again, it's easier for me to do something when you're not only inspired by what you have, whether it be a location or a few bucks to do it or whatever it would be, but the people that are around you excited by what's going into it.
Yeah, you get caught up in the excitement and inspiration. Yeah. Absolutely. That makes sense.
I've had studios taking looks at my scripts and things like this, and there's a moment there where you're like, oh, that phone's going to ring and they're going to love it or whatever. Then it never happens. But those, if you cherish those moments, then it's they add it up and you look back at it, it's like, oh, that was a neat time when I was waiting for James Woods to see if he would take a role on a project. And you know, there's moments where you're like, it could happen. But then you go, you know, that it didn't happen, at least you were trying and you reached for those stars and you reached to get better. But it, for me, I enjoy the fact that here was this little film building and building and building, and you could feel the energy, and it inspired me to write, you know, and read more Lovecraft because I hadn't touched his stuff since I was a kid. And rereading it as an adult, it had a much bigger impact on me. And I'm like, this stuff's really timeless and has just an amazing vision.
It's layers. It's all like layers. You find the great art as like you just are able to sink your teeth into it the more you learn about the craft or the more you age as a person and get more experience, you know?
And you read this and you're like, there's a reason it's been around for so many years. And inspired so many filmmakers, writers, musicians, whatever it might be. And it was, for me, of whatever anyone thinks of it, Lovecraft aficionados or whatever, for me, it was a really neat thing to be pulling from someone else's work that he basically gave the world to use. There's no copyright on his stuff. It's all public domain. And anyone can use it. And any artist that does that, especially a writer, is phenomenal.
Wow.
You know, to be able to use his name on the film and all these things, and people go, oh, it's Lovecraft. They know what it is. I mean, you don't need a big synopsis of whatever it is. If it's like, if you're a Lovecraft fan or in any way, shape, or form, you want to see it. I mean, I do personally. I mean, I'm a huge fan of his stuff and the other filmmakers who have tackled his stuff. I seek it out. I want to see it and see if they do it justice or if they fuck it up. But even when someone fucks it up, if they take things that are like, okay, that's a cool car in there, or the score is great, I can kind of give people slack, whether it's budget or a bad thing. You know, nowadays it's kind of a pity that people, worst movie ever made, it's the worst acting, the worst all this stuff. And, you know, even when I've seen the worst films, the worst acting, the worst things, I can always usually spot something. It's like, oh, look, they used the 1969 Citroen in it as the car. That's pretty cool. Or whatever it might be, and just kind of, instead of just always being negative in this day and age, try to find some positives in almost even the worst.
Well, it's just like, you know, it's also, so many people have judgments on when it comes to art. You know, it's like, I always think of like modern art, for example. And I don't know any person that doesn't walk into a modern art exhibit and doesn't think, I can do that. Yeah, but you didn't. You didn't do it. You know, somebody else did. And you shouldn't critique something or have any judgments based on what it is that your spect, you know, you're like, your lens is interfering with whatever the art is. You know what I mean? It's like, it's nice that you're like, let's cut the bullshit, find things that work and find things that, you know, are positive, because you're an artist, because you see how hard it is to do this stuff that 9 times out of 10, most people will never see all the work that goes into the writing, the directing, putting this whole thing together, funding it, getting the actors. I wanted to ask you real quick, you being a horror movie genre film director and writer, when you see somebody that you're casting for a movie, because you have some people that have very strong looks, do you just know right away? Is it a thing that you just see? You're like, this person has layers of their evil, or like, you know, they look peculiar in a way that is engaging. What is it as the director when you see somebody that when you're like, I know this person needs to be in my movie? What is that?
Well, I think it's not only it's something in the eyes. I mean, you can always tell someone who's got it, whether they're an actor or not. You know, I was having a discussion with one of the actors on the film I'm doing next, where she was like, well, how do you know he's a good actor? And I'm like, well, whether, you know, he's got a million credits or has done a lot of things, it's usually if you meet them in person, you can kind of just see if they've got a passion for whether it's music, painting, or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
They probably would have a talent at acting as well if they really were excited or interested in doing that role. And you can mine that out of them and work with them to make a great performance. Some people, you know, it's not there. I mean, you can do a billion takes. I mean, when I worked with some of them on The Deep ones, you can do a billion takes. You're not going to get a fucking De Niro performance out of it. But at the same time, being also an editor, I'm able to shoot enough coverage and instinctively, however you want to call it, know that, okay, I got it. Move on. You'll be fine. And everyone will look to me, are you sure? Trust me, I've done this enough to know that I'm like, I've seen it in, put together in my mind as we're doing it. It's a subconscious thing. I don't try to bottle it or figure it out. For whatever reason, my gut tells me, okay, you got it.
Right.
And then sure enough, when it's cut together, I'm like, he doesn't seem that awful. Or whatever it might be. He's passable. And no one goes, God, that guy stunk. it's one of those things where it's like, he looks fine now. And it's the magic of editing and finding, you know, just the right amount. It's a pain in the ass because you have to dig for it and find it in the editing room. But at the same time, it's, you know, it's an achievement to me personally when you're like, okay, that performance is passable now. Or whereas before, everyone was, you know, like, oh my God. Now they're like, I don't even notice. He seems okay.
Yeah, most people don't notice the small details of a performance that you may notice or even in the moment notices, you know, because it may be a small speck in the long, you know, beach of the movie. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just a small little moment that happens and comes and goes. So, you know, I love that you're able to see in the process, able to kind of get like perspective, because that sometimes is the hardest part. It's like when you're creating something, you know, you want to be in the moment and you want to kind of like be able to kind of tackle all the obstacles, but to also know, okay, we can get it in post. I see where this scene can go or how it can be manipulated so it works in our favor. Do you feel like you wear both hats at the same time when you're shooting? Like, or is there like one that takes more of a precedence while it's going on?
Well, I think that's the thing, you know, after, you know, again, it goes back to the preparedness and, you know, the storyboard idea. I think that's what helps me that I'm editing, and I've edited all my films under a pseudonym. So it was basically the idea that...
That's awesome.
That you, well, that's an interesting story, and I've never told anyone. I'm Jihad Farif. I edit all my films. And that name came from, I was delivering, I had to pick up a film print for the, from Sony, the Sony lot back in the day. We had done a film called No Way Back with Russell Crowe. And I had to go pick up the print from the lot. So I drive there and the guard at the front gate was basically this little Indian woman. She was, you know, really cute and really friendly. And, you know, she's like, what's your name? And I'm like, Chad Farron. I'm here to pick up the print or whatever. She writes the little pass slip, sticks it on my window. I drive in and park the car, pick up the print, leave the thing and leave the lot, park the car, whatever, deliver it, pull out the note. And I'm like, Jihad Farif. I'm like, that's awesome. And so, you know, 20 odd years later.
That's amazing. And so that's your pseudonym, the name that she thought you were. That's amazing. That's awesome. See, this is the kind of interview I love. It's like you're giving us these tidbits. Now, let me ask you, why do you feel you need that pseudonym? Is it because of the way Hollywood looks at, you know, if you're editing your own stuff, that it's like you don't have another lens, you know, somebody to edit that lens for the movie? Or is it you just feel like it's easier to kind of put it on an imaginary character? Oh, Jihad did that.
Well, I guess it goes back to the whole John Carpenter thing on Assault on Precinct 13. He did all these different things. He wrote the script, used the name John T. Chance at the editor. You know, he came up with all these different names because he was doing everything. So he didn't want it to be like John, you know, a name everywhere. And I guess it was kind of that, that's what inspired me, I guess. And the fact that at the first one, you were like, well, maybe if it stinks, they'll, like you said, blame God.
I love it. You're like, you know, most editors are the ones making the movies, you know, let's be honest, most of the time. And I like, you're like, let's blame the editor. Even though it's me, let's blame the editor. So with horror movies, there are always some cool makeup, costumes, special effects, blood and guts. You've had to say, I need more blood and guts on a couple scenes of yours. Tell me, is that like going back to being a kid and playing in the mud a little bit? Like, there's got to be a sense of it's make-believe, but it's like you're actually working with real props. Tell me what that experience is like for you.
Well, it's, you know, like being a kid, like you said, playing in the mud. I mean, you get this, you know, you've got these people who really, most effects people really dig what they're doing. They love getting in there and doing it. And you kind of feel that energy. And, you know, and when it works especially, you're just like, wow, that was exciting, because it's just an alternate, you know, world. You know, someone's being eviscerated in front of you, or a monster is coming out of the ocean, or whatever it might be. And it kind of brings you back to the primal things of, you know, being a little kid and afraid of the dark, or whatever it might be, of what's in the dark. And then you're making it, and, you know, you're with people, I think, who have just, most effects people, again, have just such an infectious energy and love of what they're doing, that it just kind of, it makes everyone on the set really kind of just, wow, what's this going to be? What's this going to, and when it works, it's like, wow, that was great. And, you know, there's something just really, you know, again, like I said, brings you back to being a kid. And that's a great feeling, you know, for any job, I think, where you can have a moment where you're like, wow, I feel new again. And, you know, excited, and, you know, and the world's not awful. And, you know, and there's not these horrible things going on. It's like, for that one moment, you're just like, a, you know, bright-eyed again.
Well, one of our past guests is an Emmy-winning makeup artist who worked on he worked on both seasons of Mandalorian. Wow. So, like, I gotta link you two together if you ever need somebody. His name's Alexei Dimitriou, and he's like awesome. But when I was interviewing him, it was like describing his job, and I was like, dude, you got the coolest job. I mean, like, you're on movie sets making toys, essentially, that are doing crazy things for characters or as props or whatever. So, like, you get to kind of, like, oversee all of the madness, but also make it look like it's a professional shoot. So that's going to be very hard to balance those two, being a kid and actually making the movie and making it what you want it to be.
Well, again, it's a great thing when you, especially, you know, a learning process and getting to the point where you try to hire people like yourself, where you've got a good connection and an energy.
Right.
And because, you know, it's just, you're going to have this symbiosis on set where, and this vibe that everyone kind of like, hey, this is fun.
Right.
Instead of going to work and dreading going there, you can't wait to get up and show up. And that's what the last few films have been for me. And I try to run all my sets that way, where everyone feels like they're a part of it and they're having fun. And that starts with picking those people that you know in your gut that are going to deliver. You know, like recently, I just, you know, the DP that we had on the new film, we had a little blowout and, you know, I had to get rid of him. But it was one of those things that I warned it before when we first met, and I told him the whole unspeakable story, the DP's this on that, and I, you know, I make sure that that's not going to happen again. And if we're not making these 15, 20 pages a day, I'm going to fire you. I got to let you know that straight up and right now. No problem, no problem. I can get this done. I do this many. Okay, let's go for it. And then he gets the schedule and he's like, holy shit. Can you sign this contract that says you won't fire me? I'm like, you're fired. You know, the fact that you're asking me to sign something that I won't fire you when I said I'd fire you if we're not making these fucking days, because every day on a low-budget film is $10,000 or whatever it might be.
Absolutely.
If we're missing that, it's just more and more money. And it's, come on.
So let me ask you, you know, they say for screenplays, it's a page a minute, roughly. So, like, when shooting, I don't know what the scale is. Like, 15 pages is what, a whole day, 2 days, 3 days?
For me, it's 1 day.
1 day, 15 pages?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, but it goes down to, you know, like the AD, the assistant director on the new film is just like, are you crazy? This is, you know, 20 pages on this day. And on paper, that stuff looks insane. But when you boil it down, it's two people in a fucking room.
Right.
Talking for, you know, half of those pages, getting up and walking into down to the elevator for another quarter of the page. I mean, it's stuff that if you have the right DP and the right look of it, where you're not spending 10 hours lighting it, it's just like, okay, this is a naturally lit thing from whatever light source. It's quick, it's fast, and if the actors are hitting their marks, you're in and out of there in 10 hours or whatever.
Dude, you're a movie. You're a movie house's dream director. You're a movie house's dream director. You're like, no director is going to shoot like that with that ambitious of a schedule and be like, I can pull this off. That's awesome, dude. You're efficient.
And again, it goes back to being willing to compromise. If you're like, okay, this isn't working, let's just do this in this shot and that shot, two shots, 20 pages, and get the fuck out of it. It'll
right.
cut together and it'll work. And if the actors have a chemistry and an energy and their performance is good, you totally sell it. It's like you don't need to spend, you know, extra time on something you know as an editor you're not going to use anyway. It's like, why shoot this shot if you're not going to do it? It's like in the Deep Ones, we had a scene where they're at the table drinking wine and talking, and I'm like, okay, it's just a two shot on them and a two shot on them, and we're done with it. Let's move on. And the actors are like, well, don't you want to get close-ups? I'm like, no, it's fine. Felt good. Move on. if you go with, you know, sometimes you do stuff for safety, sometimes you don't. If there's no time and it felt good, move on.
Wow. And do, like, when's your time to review it? Do you review it on set to know that you have it? Never? That's awesome, dude.
If it's a stunt or something, you might want to look, you know, at the playback on the camera. I never let actors look at playback, number one, especially on set. The whole thing for me is an act. I'm always right behind the DP, whether it's looking through the monitor on the camera or behind looking at it. And just if it looks good, we move on. If he's got a question on focus or whatever, we might replay it to make sure if it's there. But otherwise, you know, every minute counts. It's like, let's just get on to the next thing. If he wants to go back and double check during lunch or whatever it might be, he can feel free to do that. But I really, it's kind of like this movie, The Deep One. It's done. I'm on to the next one. I'm not thinking about it really anymore.
Right.
To me, I've when editing, you're seeing these scenes for the first time. It's exciting when they work. When they cut together, you're like, yes. And then you watch it over and over and over and over. And then when it's put together, over and over and over. So that energy and that excitement is gone long ago. Until you see it again with an audience.
Right.
On a big screen or whatever, then you're seeing it for the first time and you're like, oh, that worked. You can kind of pick up on their energy. And I don't know if it's psychic. I don't know if everyone has sort of a sixth sense. I don't know what it is, but for me personally,
no, you know what it is?
If they hate it, I can feel it, whatever.
No, you know, it's really great because my songwriting teacher in college used to tell me this. He's like, you know, you could write a song and think it's the best song in the world. And then you bring it in and you play it for five or six people, you immediately are hearing it the way they're hearing it.
Right.
And you can tell when there are weaknesses, when it doesn't flow. And it's like you experience it in a very kind of like out of body way. In the same way that a film, when you're watching with an audience, you're feeling how things are reacting, what the energy in the room is, if there's excitement, if there's lulls. So you're feeling all those things. So absolutely, you're not, it's not that you're psychic or anybody else is psychic. You're all in the room experiencing it together, dude. That's the magic of it. Now, there has to be some parts of the filmmaking process where something takes you out of the moment. Maybe it's like, you know, like Spielberg used to always say, it was the shark in Jaws, because the shark never worked, you know? It was always some contraption or always some effect that, you know, what was the, like, you know, maybe on The Deep Ones or any other movie, what was something that kind of took you out of the moment when you're just trying to focus on making the movie?
Well, that gets touchy. I mean, you know, I try not to be... offensive, especially with, because there was, you know, it's funny, I did a commentary for Unspeakable for the DVD, you know, 20 years ago. And it really is, I listened to it somewhat recently. It's Tim Muscatel and I, and it's one of the most foul, offensive. I mean, I would be blacklisted by Me Too or whatever it might be for the shit that's said on that thing.
Right.
And it's just like you learn not to censor yourself, because I can give a fuck. There's really nothing they can cancel me for. I canceled long ago.
Right.
And learned to basically, and when you said, you know, like, why aren't these actors or directors working? It's like, go sell your fucking house and make your own movie if they canceled you. And make it so great that no one can ignore that you, you know, rape the 12-year-old or whatever the fuck it is. Embrace that and just, you know, go with it. So on the Deep Ones, I mean, there was just a flare up with one of the camera crew and the sound guy. And, you know, I don't want to get into that because it was kind of personal for both of them. But it came to the point where, you know, the camera department basically said, look, if you don't fire this guy, we're going to walk. And it was like, man, because I'd worked with the sound guy for years and years and years. And I know it was a misunderstanding, but I had to let him go. And it was one of those things where I just didn't like the way that all went down, because it taints the whole thing. So we were halfway done, and then the rest of the half of the movie was tainted. We had to get a new sound guy, and it was just kind of, it didn't have the same energy that it did, and it was just kind of just a foulness. And for the rest of the movie, there's bits of that where I see, and I knew that we shot that day there, and like the rape of the sea of Dagon at the end, that was with the new guy, the sound, and it was not, the energy was just bad.
Wow.
And so those things, you know, kind of taint the entire movie for me.
Well, I love that you have a team. You have a team player aspect to making movies, and I think that is something that can be lost. It can get lost, you know, in the process, because it is. You have to have a vision, but you also have to be able to work as a team together, collaborate, and know when there's a give and take, and when to like make the calls that need to happen, and sometimes they're uncomfortable. It's like growing pains on some level, you know? Well, let's play the trailer, shall we? Because I want good ones.
I'm surprised.
Mr. Marsh!
Wow.
Is that a view or what?
How long have you two been married?
3 years.
Oh, you're going to make a wonderful mom.
Glory. Glory. Neighbors around here, we're part of a seaside commune, the Solar Beach Colony.
Welcome, Ashley, Alexandra.
So happy you made it.
I think this whole Solar Beach community is a little Stepford-like.
Petri seems to fit in real well.
You smoke?
I get a little loopy when I smoke.
It'll help you focus for your journey. Focus. Focus.
See the light?
I did hear. When you hear the click of the light, you'll be awake.
Petri! Hello?
You've been chosen!
You're in danger. They're watching always.
They took my job.
You brought it to us. You made your choice.
I found a hidden camera. They've been watching us this entire time. What is out there?
Open the door. Don't be afraid.
We need to call the police. What is wrong with you? You'll be like me, the mother to the Deep Ones.
So awesome, man. Dude, it's, you know what? You can't watch that trailer and not want to be pulled in. You just like, you get pulled in. There's so many things about it. It's like, this is pulling you on so many different levels. Tell me how hard it was to even just kind of edit the trailer to make it that way.
Well, you know, that's funny because I had edited a different trailer that played festivals and did all that kind of stuff for those things. And then the distributor picked it up and they recut it. And they did a much better job at the, I guess, I hate to say commercial, but more polished, you know, because I'm not a polished guy. So my stuff is more, you know, fast cutting and all this all over the place. And they did something that's a little more universal. If that makes sense, and yeah. Actually a better trailer, because I mean, cutting trailers is such an art.
It's an art for sure.
You really need someone that knows the thing to have something that really gets. There's times I felt I've nailed.
I'll call you back.
So there's times I've cut things that work, but when you have someone who's actually that's what they do for a living, they're decent at it. It's a whole new ball game, and I'm really the distributor did a fine job of. Whoever they had cut it together, and it really intrigued me when I first thought. I'm like, oh, I want to see that.
I could live with this. Let me ask you, what did you shoot it on? Did you use a Red? What camera was your camera of choice?
We used the Panasonic's version of the Red. They shoot What's Up Sol or whatever that show is with it. It's, you know, one of the Netflix, you know, approved cameras, one of the first thing. But Jeff Billings, our DP, he owned this great package, this camera package, light package, and then we rented Arri super speed lenses to kind of give it this shining feel, because those are
totally has that vibe. Totally has that vibe.
So I mean, for me, it's like no, the camera necessarily doesn't matter. I mean, the Arri makes a great camera, Red makes a great camera. They're all great, but the lenses that you get for them. Really is what makes it. And for me, I always try to rent vintage, you know, 1970s, 60s, 80s, whatever it is, lenses, because there's something, you know, I don't know what it is, the quality of hand craftsmanship that was in those decades is, you can't beat it. So
can you look at a movie and tell, like, what lens, like, decade it was probably made in?
No, I mean, I guess, you know, it would be hard. There's just something when I'm on set physically looking through it, and then you see there's just you get more just,
a dynamic range, maybe
a grit, if you want to say that, with some of the stuff they have imperfections. You know, there's something that's just, you know, whether it's their age or whether it's the glass at the time, whether it's, you know, a guy Giuseppe put it together in, you know, 1972, and they were used by Solaris or whatever it is. And it has a history.
Right.
There's something to that. And so yeah,
there's a magnificence. I'm like that with microphones. Like I like really old microphones because they're the best. It's the same craftsmanship that you're probably looking at for the lenses. Does a lens take you in or out of a shot, like as a director?
Well, I think for me, it really, it depends on the scene and what you're striving to get out of that. And a lens can just really make it, whether you're using a 50 millimeter or a 70 millimeter, whatever it is that's, you're trying to get the emotion out of the characters in that thing is decides which lens you should use. But again, it's another instinct thing of, okay, this feels right. Let's go with this lens or, you know.
Right.
Or go get a wider angle. We don't need to see, you know, the lines in their faces of the stabbing. It works good from a long shot and go with that. And to me, it's, again, you see it through the camera. I'm like, that looks good. Well, let's try a 50 millimeter. Okay, that looks better. Let's go with that. So there's some prep time for each scene, especially when they're lighting, that you can decide which lens you want to use on it for that particular shot.
Let me ask you, too, as a horror film director, what scares you when you watch movies or just in life? Like, what are the things? Is there an anxiety that, you know, there's like the thought of something happening or the anticipation, or is it the actual moment of something actually happening? What is the thing that scares you the most?
I guess it would more be the moment of something happening. I try not to think about, you know, what could be, right. You know, I smoke like a pack of cigarettes a day. I stopped eating meat long ago when I was like 16 years old, and I'm 48 now or whatever I am. So it's not necessarily a health reason, but it's one of those things that you're you realize what you're doing to the environment or the animals, and those make your decisions and whatever. But it's not, it was never for me like a political statement or a thing. It was just what I felt. I got to know these animals. I knew these cows, met these pigs, and whatever. And I don't want to meet them anymore. And being a kid on a farm in the Midwest, you'd be called a faggot. You'd be called all these weird things by my parents because you're not the normal person that you're supposed to be. What's wrong with you, you queer? Why aren't you eating meat? You know, we're out of time. And so for me, that's why it's so weird that everyone now is so thin-skinned. And I'm really actually appreciative that my parents were this name-calling, gruff, rough and tough thing, because people can call me whatever the hell they want, and it just rolls off my back. I really, it means nothing. So when I see people, you know, going so crazy because someone called them an N-word or something like that, it's a horrible thing, don't get me wrong, but is it worth killing someone for?
Right.
Because everyone should step back and just say, hey, look, treat everyone like you'd want to be treated. If you don't want to eat meat, great. No, if you don't want to do this, great, but don't try to ram these ideals down other people's throats, because
man, I learned that ambassador to the world, dude.
I learned back then that some people, and I would just not even tell people. They're like, what do you want to eat? I'll just have a salad. Because I didn't want to get into the whole story and then have someone think, what's wrong with this weirdo? Why doesn't he want to eat my, you know, rabbit? No,
that was going to be one of my questions, because when you were just talking about killing animals and seeing it and all of that, that has to affect you. I mean, especially it's like, if you're an artist too, you're going to be feel more compassion towards an animal like that. So I figured you probably were a vegetarian after that experience, just because that's going to change the way you look at the process. It's like, it's not going to make you want to have a burger, you know? It's like, it's going to make you think about what was behind the burger, you know?
But then, you know, you'd explain to people and then you would wonder, well, why aren't they seeing it the same way I was?
Right. You know?
But I stopped that long ago, even worrying about other people's thoughts or trying to change their whatever.
Then you're the truest artist of artists, man, because that's that you're making art without any kind of like censoring or care of what people think. And that's honestly, those are the purest artists. That's the way it should be. It's like make art to make art. And that is what makes it badass, because, you know, I think artists sometimes can be swayed by suits, or, you know, they can be swayed by audiences, or they can be swayed. And it's like, man, that's never how I've never made art like that. It's like in a world where like people's attention spans are like 2 minutes or 3 minutes or 3 seconds, I open my records with 9 minute songs. I'm like, if you don't want to pay attention, you can tune out, but I'm going to make something that I think is beautiful or great or dynamic or something powerful. And I love when another artist in a different medium, this is why I came up with this show and I've been doing it for so long, because it's like it's so hard to find artists that kind of see the same vision and have the same kind of work ethic. And that's what it's all about, you know? So I wanted to ask you have this beautiful sweeping shot of the ocean.
Right.
You, I assume you got that with a drone, or how did you get that? Because it's such a bitchin' shot in the trailer. I mean, it's one of my favorite shots in the whole thing, but it also, you did some really cool character shots where you had like close-ups of a character in like a party scene, or even just a close-up of a character where you shot them looking like you were kind of getting an upward glance at them, so it makes them feel like it looks like it's like a dominating aerial view, you know what I mean? So how did you kind of come up with these shots, or what was your inspiration behind them?
Yeah, no, it was, again, you know, The Shining, the opening shots with the helicopter through the mountains as they're driving was, you know, just a great thing. So that when Jeff got involved, it's like, do you happen to have a drone? And he's like, sure, well, let's grab these, you know, shots. It just adds a little more production value, especially, you know, an any budget film. If you're going to have a film within the first 10 minutes, you should have something interesting. And whether it's a sweeping shot or a crane shot or something that makes it look a little more expensive than it is, go for it. Because most distributors only watch the first 15 minutes of a movie and they pick it up or they don't pick it up. So I've learned if you can make it look bigger from the first 10 minutes, try that effect. And, you know, it was that idea of trying to open with a film big, and then The Shining was the main inspiration for a lot of the
I love Kubrick, man. He's like one of my favorites, favorite directors of all time. Like I love that you just have picked up on all these like little traits that they've done, you know, that to make a story or a picture or a shot a certain thing, and that's what makes that's the thing that really it like inspires me when I see an artist's inspirations in their work. You know, so I hope you continue to do that. Where can people find you if they want you to direct their next feature, or you know, they want to ask you to write their next screenplay? Where can people find you?
Well, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on all that jazz. And they can always email me at chat@crappyworldfilms.com. And
I love that that's your email too, man. I looked at that, I'm like, this cat, he's got a sense of humor about the whole process. This is great.
It's like every time I take, you know, a 20-cent check from the distributor for one of my older movies, and I go to the bank, and the teller's like, Crappy World Film. And they give a little chuckle, and they, is that for real? And I'm like, you're cashing the check. It's got to be for real.
Well, I hope you continue to make movies, Chad. You've been a wonderful guest. You have an open window to always showcase your films here because you're a great cat and you're a great artist, and I want to see more of your movies, man. I'm going to have to go through all your movies now. I'm going to work backwards. I'm going to go from deep ones and go backwards, but please keep us posted.
They're on Tubi. They're free. Check them out.
You know what? That's what I'm going to do. Honestly, that's one of the joys I have with doing this show too, is like you see movies and hear music that's under the radar. It's like, you know, I go to film festivals for the same reason. So, man, I'm a fan of art. I'm a fan of movies. And music is here for me, but movies are like right here. They're right there. So, man, I'll definitely check out your work. I'm excited to see this movie, The Deep Ones, and I hope everybody else checks it out April 23rd. Just promote where it's being played and what time and all that stuff right now.
Will do.
No, go tell our listeners real quick.
Oh, I have no idea.
Oh, okay. So
you were mentioning some of them. I'm like, really?
I think it's played April 23rd, 7 p.m. at Lemley NoHo. So yeah, there you go. That's awesome. Yeah, you could have been writing that down, man. But yeah, man, you've been a great guest. You're a great artist. I look forward to many more movies from you, and maybe we'll collaborate someday, man. That would be awesome. Make it happen. I'm holding you to it. It's on tape now.
You got it.
Awesome, bro. Thanks again for taking the time, man, and good luck with all your films, especially the good ones and the deep ones. Did I say it right? The deep ones.
The deep ones,
well,
is a good one.
The deep ones in your movies, I'm sure, are great, so I'm excited to see all of them, man. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, man, and let's keep in touch, and open. You have an open window to come back, man, so anytime, man, all right?
I'll take you up on that.
You take care, stay healthy, stay safe, stay creative, bro.
You too. Thanks.
Be good.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.